versatile artist, Fortner gained global acclaim for his work with fellow Grammy winner Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, cementing his status as one of today's most prolific and masterful jazz musicians. Further information and tickets at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
.7 FM, KPFK, Los Angeles. Today.
The Expansion Zone with Sonia Barrett.
Everybody's talking about consciousness. Everybody wants that eternal kiss.
On the Expansion Zone, we examine life and our quest to understand who and what we are and of the vastness of human potentials. We explore the making of our world from quantum physics to parapsychology, health, sociology, and philosophy, along with practical living. You are reminded of the possibilities in creating personal change. So for an hour, we'll stimulate and expand the mind.
Well, welcome once again to another edition of The Expansion Zone with Sonia Barrett. I am your host, Sonia Barrett, and it is Monday. Thank you so much for tuning in to KPFK 90.7 FM, and also for those who are listening at kpfk.org. Wishing you a great week, and of course, encouraging you to shut out the noise when possible and find your center, because there's a lot of noise. There's always noise. But right now, it seems like the volume is really up. So we have, Earth Day actually coming up on the 22nd. And of course, my interview today, our talk today, just happened to be sort of reflective of Earth Day. So today's topic is going to be about ancient trees, living time, what the Earth remembers. So we're going to be speaking about dendrochronology. And our guest today is Valerie Truitt, editor of the book In the Circle of Ancient Trees. And her bio, Valerie Truitt is a professor in the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research at the University of Arizona. She is a dendroclimatologist using tree rings to study the climate of the past and how it has influenced ecosystems and human history. In 2023, she was appointed the inaugural scientific director of the Federal Center of Expertise on Climate in Belgium. Professor Truitt is the author of Tree Story, John Hopkins, the winner of the Worldwide Funds 2020 Jan Walker Prize, and the gold winner of the 2020 Forward Indies Award in Ecology and Environment. For this book, Valerie has collaborated with experts from around the world, each of whom has contributed an account of an ancient tree from their region. So, Valerie, I welcome you for the first time here on the Expansion Zone, and I'm excited to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. The honor is all mine, Sonia. I'm really, really excited to be here as well.
Yes. So, I mean, I have chat with other scientists, other authors, because I'm fascinated by trees and nature, and because I'm such a forest person. And so, I was excited to have this conversation with you as well. So let's say, what first drew you to the study of trees as more than just maybe biological organisms? What drew you to this study?
Yeah, so I studied rings in trees and in wood. And what really first drew me into it was, the field work and the lab work. So we go out into the field to collect samples. We get to go out into the forests across the world. So that's exciting. And then the lab work, I really love doing the lab work as well. So I started studying tree rings for my master's degree back in Belgium. I'm from Belgium originally. And I collected tree ring samples in Tanzania, in Eastern Africa, brought them back to Belgium. And then when I went into the lab, and when you're doing lab work for dendrochronology, you're looking at these samples of wood through a microscope. And when you look at wood through a microscope, it's majestic. It is beautiful, yet it all makes sense. Every cell in wood has a function. So it's very functional, but at the same time, there's these beautiful patterns in the wood. So I kind of got carried away by that. I even get carried away now talking about it. And then what you're doing when you're looking at the tree, when you're doing dendrochronology, is you're trying to match the patterns that you see in the rings of different trees. So it's really a bit like a jigsaw puzzle, solving a jigsaw puzzle. So there, for my master's degree, I was spending hours, days in the lab, looking at this beautiful wood, solving jigsaw puzzles. And I mean, right? So I really totally got hooked.
Yeah, I could see that though. I mean, because of the way I am, I totally see that. Now, this is just me throwing a side question, but I'm just curious, as a child, did you have that interest? Because so many times what we become later on in our lives, it's a completely far away from what we were thinking, you know, as kids. I thought I was going to be on Broadway, right? That was my whole thing. I'm going to be on Broadway. I'm going to sing and dance.
100%. Yeah. Yep. No, I did not. I grew up in, as I mentioned, in Belgium, which is a very densely populated country. I grew up in the suburbs, so very little nature around. But I did always have, I really always wanted to travel. I did have that urge to go and explore the world. And I'd, even when I was a kid, when I was in high school, I first learned about climate change and fossil fuel combustion and how the two were linked. And that really worried me. I was 16. I heard about it in a geography class. And I was like, wait, if this is true, this is a big problem. So I'd always been really interested in that topic. And then the combination of, you know, being able to explore the world while studying our climate using trees, that, you know, that kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. I think the more you become engaged, even if you're not a scientist studying the trees, but what I found is that over time, because I know my audience is probably tired of me going, I'm a hiker. But I love, I do. My husband calls me a forest fairy, right? Because, because I love being out there in that experience. And it's not just about the beauty. I mean, you really feel this, it comes alive. I can't even say it comes alive. You become aware, I think, of its aliveness and its intelligence. And so that's what I experience when I go out there. So it changes my conversation with nature. Now, when you are reading, you're looking at the rings, what exactly, I know you sort of gave an idea about this sort of puzzle, but what are you actually probably reading? Is there anything you're looking for?
Yep. Good question. I think one of the things I like about being a dendrochronologist is that the concept of tree rings is familiar to very many people, right? Many people, if you're a forest fairy, then probably as a kid, you've looked at the stump of a tree and counted the rings and to get an idea of how old that tree was. So many people have done that as kids or even as adults. So many people understand that the trees form a ring each and every year, right? And by counting those rings, you can then get an idea of the age of the tree. But not all the rings are the same. Some rings are wider than others. Some are denser than others. And so the sequence of rings, if you have a 100-year-old tree with 100 rings, there's a pattern in those rings. There's a pattern of wide and narrow rings. And trees that grow in the same location at the same time, they will all show that same pattern of wide and narrow rings. Because what drives a very important part of what makes that pattern, of what makes trees grow a lot in one year and less in another year, is the climate in which the trees grow. So, for instance, where you and I are at in the American Southwest, if it's a dry year, the trees are not going to grow a lot. They're going to form a very narrow ring because they don't have enough energy and enough water to grow a lot. So you will find those narrow rings in all the trees in the American Southwest. And because the trees form the same pattern, you can start, it's called cross-dating, we can start matching the patterns between the trees, not just with living trees, but also with dead trees and with historical wood and archaeological wood and so forth. So what we're looking at is, one, the trees that best record climate, that form a narrow ring every time there's a dry year. And two, you know, we want to go as far back in time as possible. So we're looking at really, we're looking for old trees as well. Those are the two big components.
Yeah. There was another question in reference to that I was going to ask you about. It'll come back to me. But as far as the memory then of trees, what are some things that we can figure that there's memory of? Because when I go to the tree, I mean, obviously, yes, my audience knows that I get like way out there, but I do. I say to the tree, is there anything? Let me know. I want to know more about the history of the planet and anything that you want to share with me. I do. I have that conversation.
That's very kind. It's great to have that conversation. That's kind of what I do when but then through my research, the rings, right? Maybe in a little more, maybe the trees.
A little bit more scientific way you're doing this.
In a more specific way, let's put it that way. But that's really how I understand my science is I'm trying to read what these trees were witnesses to history, right? Exactly as you say, they've witnessed, these are 1,000-year-old trees.
Incredible.
They live on a time scale completely different from ours, and they have witnessed things throughout their lifespan. And they're reliable witnesses. I always say the trees don't lie, right? They don't have emotions. Mm-hmm. So they don't have, they don't lie about what happened to them. It's up to us to interpret correctly what it is that they're trying to tell us. And so my field of expertise is to study past climate through tree rings. So trees can tell us a lot about past climate, about drought, but also about hot and cold years, about storms, about hurricanes. Another thing that is really fascinating is that they can tell us about forest fires that happened in the past. They can fires can scar the trees, can leave scars in the trees, and we can date when those scars happen by looking at the tree rings. Insect outbreaks, same thing. Trees can tell us about that. They can tell us about the competition, whether the forest has been more dense or more open in the past. And then very importantly, they can tell us a lot about our own human history. So because people have been using wood as a resource since the very beginning of modern humanity, when wood is preserved, the rings in the wood are preserved. So we can not only date, for instance, when ancient Puebloan ruins here in the Southwest, when they were built, that they were built in medieval times, 1,000 years ago. We can date exactly when each tree was cut that then later turned into the beams of these archaeological sites. We can date violins, Stradivari violins, or paintings that were painted on oak panels. But we can even look at where the wood came from, like where was the forest located that wood of the Stradivari violin, for instance, was made of. And so we can look at ancient trade patterns amongst humans as well. And the cool thing is, I can keep talking, the cool thing
yeah,
is...
No, it's interesting.
We use the same technique, dendrochronology, to study and past climate and, and past forest history and human history. So by using the same technique to study these three systems, human systems, climate systems, forest systems that are all, related to each other, as you mentioned, that all interact with each other, we use the same technique to give a holistic view of these interactions between the three systems.
Yes. I mean, it's an incredible library. I mean, I'm sure there's another word that can be used, but just listening to what you're describing about all of this information, here it is on, it's not flawed information. It's there. It's not like somebody took it and wrote it. It's like you're looking at actual real data, So that's fascinating.
It is fascinating. It also makes that once you're a dendrochronologist, it's hard, I'll admit, it's hard to trust other sources of information because you're so used to this having a very precise date mm-hmm. on things and having very accurate information, because there's other ways of studying past climate as well. You can look at stalagmite in caves, or you can look at ice cores or sediments in lakes and so forth. But for all of these, the dating, they don't necessarily have that absolute dating of forming a ring or a layer each and every year. So it's all, as a dendrochronologist, we're really spoiled. We're really spoiled by the of the information that we get.
That makes sense as to why you would be, because like you said, it's not like somebody can go in and just change the information. You can't change it. It is what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
So looking at that, now, are there some specific trees? And I'm asking this question based on the root of the tree and the extension of that root, how far that root goes. I would imagine that there is so much more there for those trees. And it doesn't matter. I mean, I won't say it doesn't matter, but what I also start to realize, and I'm going to have you answer that as well, that question. But what I started to realize, because I started wondering, why is it that I am okay and I am appreciative of even when everything is dry? There is an aliveness to even everything that it, when it looks like it's all dead, there is something still alive. It's like another layer of being alive that we don't see.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Oh, totally. It's like hibernation, right? They stop, the trees stop growing in winter. It looks like they're dead, like they're, they're really hibernating, but they're just saving energy to then start again the next spring. And knowing, I really like what you said, knowing that it's dry and it looks like nothing's happening, but that's because they're conserving their energy for what's about to come. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So now we can go back to that question about the different types of trees and the roots. What makes the difference in terms of the history they might hold?
Yes. Good question. So in the book, in the Circle of Ancient Trees, I have invited 10 of my colleagues, dendrochronologists, to each write a professional memoir, a chapter that's a professional memoir about an iconic tree species that they've dedicated part of their career to. And so they're beautiful stories about these ancient trees and how they have inspired my colleague scientists to study the history that they can extract from them. And by ancient, I mean, you know, some of these trees, the bristlecone pines, are almost 5,000 years old. The sequoias, the giant sequoias in the Sierra Nevada mountains in California, can be more than 3,000 years old. In Chile and in South America, the trees can be more than 3,000 years old as well. So in terms of the roots, the oldest trees on Earth that we know that we know of are typically located on the west coast of the Americas. So in Chile or in California and the Great Basin. There are some very old trees in other regions as well, but really not much can top what's happening in the Western Americas. So to give you an example, I mentioned the bristlecone pines are the world's oldest trees. Oldest living tree is more than 4,600 years old, oldest known living tree. If you go to Europe, we sampled the oldest known living tree there, and it was just over 1,000 years old. So that's also really very old, but it is a very difference, a big difference from what we see in the American West.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I think, that's why for what you do, the work that you do, that's like a kid. I mean, it's work. But it's always different. There's things that are the same, but it's always different because, you know, every tree is going to tell maybe a little bit of a different story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's, I think I realized also when writing this book and my first book, I think that's why I like being a dendrochronologist. I get very easily bored.
You won't get bored with the trees.
I mean, yeah, exactly. But I never get bored in this field of science. There are so many stories to tell about human history, about climate history. I mean, climate, there's so many things to talk about. There's fires, there's hurricanes, there's snowstorms, there's floods, there's drought. It's everything, right? I mean, and then linking that to human history, seeing how we talked about the ancient Pueblo and seeing how their migration patterns, how climate might have played a role in that, or how climate might have played a role in the fall of the Roman Empire or in the disintegration of the Mayan civilization. Like, you're really putting these big picture ideas together. It never gets boring. Yeah,
no, absolutely. Because our this is maybe a little bit of a different subject matter, but still, when you mentioned the fall of many of these places, and I thought about, is it Pompeii? I mean, the things that happen in such a very bizarre way that's unexplainable, but it's nature driven somehow.
And
it's coming from a core. It's coming from, you know, where it's deep. It's not just on the surface. And so that, you know, as a scientist too, that fascinates me because nothing is ever topical. You know, how far does this go? How deep does it go? What triggered it? So that's why I share your fascination about trees. Let's see. I have a number of things that I do want to ask you. I think we probably may need to take our station break right now. Let's take a quick station break. And when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Valerie Truitt. And of course, you know, hopefully I'm pronouncing her name correctly. So stay tuned and we'll be right back after this brief break.
You know that cabin you don't use anymore? If the upkeep just doesn't seem worth it, consider donating it to KPFK. We'll assign a real estate expert to manage the process and help maximize the value. And since we're a nonprofit, your donation is tax deductible. The process is easy, and the impact on KPFK's future can be lasting. If you have land or real estate you no longer need, it could become a powerful way to support the programs you care about. Learn more today at kpfk.org/real estate or call 844-277-4663.
And we are back. Of course, we are coming to you from KPFK 90.7 FM in Southern California, and we are streaming live at kpfk.org. You are listening to The Expansion Zone with Sonia Barrett. That's me, your host, and our guest today is Valerie Choate. We are discussing her book, In the Circle of Ancient Trees. And I am... If you're not into trees or into nature, I am telling you, man, you're missing out on a lot, because they are the ones that keep us going. They're the ones that allow us to continue to have our incredible human experience, good, bad, and indifferent. But I think that was one of the fascinating things for me. And I think there's a sense of gratitude, you know, in my mind, and I'm looking and I'm thinking, okay, so without you, we don't have air. We basically don't, what we need, oxygen, we're not going to be able to breathe in a healthy way. So now for you, is there anyone, I'm going to ask some other things, but is there any one particular maybe story from the collection that hit home for you, or was, you know, kind of stood out more of one of the stories that was shared?
I think the one chapter that and the stories told in it that I invited these 10 scientists, and I was hoping that the sum would be bigger than the individual stories, but I didn't know how good some of these chapters would be. And so the very last chapter is about the ancient trees of Fitzroya's in Chile. And my Chilean colleague who wrote it, Jonathan Baricevich, his grandfather was a forest ranger. And he tells a story about how his grandfather brought him to the forest when he was a little kid amongst these like 3,000-year-old trees, and how his passion and his love for these trees was really instilled in him intuitively when he was a kid. And now he's a world famous scientist doing like top notch science, and just the story of how deeply he cares about these trees, which are threatened by drought and deforestation and all of this. It's really beautiful. That really hit home for me, because it's very different. I mentioned that I didn't have that kind of experience growing up in the suburbs in Belgium, and even though the story was so different from my personal experience, the way he writes about it makes you feel his deep connection with these forests that he grew up in and now works on.
I can completely understand that. Maybe I didn't think about it until later on, but as a kid, I loved thunder and lightning, and so other kids would be afraid of it, but I wasn't. But instead, I was very fascinated by it, and I liked being out in the rain, just all of that entire experience. But, you know, I figure later on is because I was born in Jamaica in Westmoreland, in an area where it was very forest, you know, it's very forest-like, very much so, you know, so it's raining all the time. So I must have heard a lot of lightning and thunder while I was in my mother's womb, and my appreciation for it probably started from that point. Because, you know, when you're in the womb, you're hearing everything. But so I can understand with that story, that exposure. Now, what are there any concerns that you have, knowing what you know and what you see of history, what's happened in the past, and tracking that to where we are now? What are some things that you might find a bit concerning? And is this nature-driven, or is it probably more humanity-driven? Because we live in a high-level now technological time.
Yes, yeah. So I think one thing I've learned from studying the role of past climate change, and by past I mean over the in history, in the fall and rise of human civilizations, for instance, the role of climate change in the disintegration of the Roman Empire, as I mentioned. Climate change is never the only aspect that comes into play that is a decisive factor on whether an empire is going to rise or fall. But what we see is the interplay. So when it's not just climate change that decides, it's really what is important is the socioeconomic structure of the society that is experiencing climate change. And that is what worries me now, because nowadays we have all of the scientific knowledge, we have all of the technology, as you mentioned, we even have the capital that's necessary to address our current climate situation and to prevent it from getting much worse. Yet we decide not to do that. We decide to go another route. And that is what worries me, because in addition to that, or the socioeconomic structure of our civilization is not it's not helping with addressing mm-hmm. the effects of climate change. Yeah. And so that's a lesson I've learned from the past, that it's never just climate change alone. It is the societies, it's the structure of the societies that are experiencing climate change that is a very deciding factor on whether, on how bad the impacts of that climate change are.
Yeah. And in you saying that, I think one of the things that that I find to be clear is that the planet is such an incredibly solid and strong and force that I think the concern at some point is really about humans, basically, because the planet seems that it will do what it needs to do to keep going.
You're right. You're absolutely whether, right.
Yeah, whether yeah. you be there or not, that's another story. But the planet, if it has to dump everyone, I mean, and that's kind of how I see it. I'm like, oh no, Mother Earth she's got this covered. If you don't behave, she's going to react. So I think that's something that, you know, people have to keep in mind. The planet will more than likely continue, but people, you know, you can make your decisions as to how you handle things and what you do. Now, there is there's a couple of other authors, I've never interviewed them, but they've talked about the trees and this sort of family. I want to know if you've seen that. They talk about trees and their connection with each other from that standpoint. Have you seeing anything from your angle of research to show that level of, I hate to use the word intelligence because they are extremely intelligent, but familiar to us then, what we would define as families and connections?
Yeah, I'm a little, on the one hand, I'm a little wary of, we call it anthropomorphizing trees. You know, they're not people. We should not try and turn them into people that communicate with each other. On the other hand, forests are ecosystems. They are systems. They are connected to each other. They function as a whole. Trees function individually as well, but of course they function as a whole as well. Of course, trees are linked to each other, and even the pattern that we see in the tree rings, that there's this pulse that all the trees react in a similar way, and that they store the conditions in which the forest grows in a similar way year after year after year. That's already a sign that there is a commonality amongst that it's a family of trees, as you called it.
There's a different kind of conversation, I think, that goes on, which is what you're talking about. But we tend to relate things to our understanding as to how we operate as humans. But it's clear, like what you're describing, sure, it's a system. And yes, we might want to term it as a conversation. But in order for the system to work efficiently, it's built in, right, where these certain actions take place among them.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's important to, in terms of science communication, it's important sometimes, as you mentioned, to anthropomorphize, to compare other organisms to humans, because that's what we understand best. It's important to explain a concept to people who are not foresters, but we shouldn't take it too far. Trees are not, but you're absolutely right. So it's forests are systems, and you know, individual trees can be thousands of years old. Forests can be many thousand years old, and they wouldn't survive. They wouldn't grow that old and grow that into such a sustainable holistic system unless it was, you know, it was all connected and there was some intelligence, exactly as you say, expressed in the structure of that forest.
Yes. And yes, and I completely understand what you're saying there. And I think, again, we go back to, you know, our definition of intelligence based on, you know, obviously human beings, but from that standpoint, yes, there is intelligence in the sense that we see a working system,
right?
Because we're still here, so there is a working system in place. So that's fascinating. And I think one of the documentaries I saw a while back, it was fascinating looking at mycelium, really kind of understanding the. Oh man, I can't even think of any words to describe that, but to understand a deeper level as to what its role is from the beginning of time, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, from that pretty standpoint. Much, yeah, very early on, much earlier than trees themselves, yeah.
Yeah. And how that relates to us and the forming of life forms.
Yes.
So right. So we could get all kinds of deep with it, with the trees and going that far back before life forms, because they were there before. I mean, trees were there before.
Yeah.
Many forms of life,
including humans. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Including, which is really what I'm talking about, because we always like to think that, you know, we're like, you know, number one.
Such a blip. We're a blip.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like we like to think that we are at the height of, you know, of everything. And so I'm always like, boy, we're in trouble if that's the case. We're in really big trouble. So let's see. What is probably one of the most humbling realizations you've had through your work? And you've said a lot of things here that I could read into that, but if there's something specific that just kind of brought you to a wow.
Yeah, I can be very specific. The first time, so when I first moved to the US, I started working in California in the Sierra Nevada mountains, and the first tree sample I brought back to the lab. So when you sample a tree in the field, you don't know how old the tree is. It's not until you bring the sample back to the lab and you start actually counting its rings and cross dating that you know how old the tree is. that you sampled, and the first sample that I dated in the lab, and that was more than 1,000 years old, that was humbling. That was absolutely humbling. Mm-hmm. It was like, I here at that time, I was maybe 30 years old. And then I started thinking, this is like more than 30 times my lifespan I'm looking at here in this tree. And not only that, but this was a tree from the Sierra Nevada mountains, right? Where 1,000 years ago, we don't know anything or hardly anything about what happened in that forest in the Sierra Nevada mountains 1,000 years ago. Because there were people, indigenous peoples, but they didn't have a tradition of writing things down. So we don't have any written records of what the conditions were like back then. So to study these trees, not only that are so much older than you can imagine, but then to also realize that you hold a piece of history in your hands that we haven't known before, that you can extract information that no one's known before.
It's humbling.
It's humbling, and it's what keeps me coming back to science time after time. To know that you're the first person to know something or to see something it's so humbling and powerful at the same time.
Yeah. So would you say, because this is what it sounds like, so there are certain aspects of your perception when it comes to time, I think that has changed. Because how can it not, though? You're like a speck, yeah. Right? Count your age, you're like a speck.
100%. And the interesting thing is that it also makes me feel even more responsible over my lifetime to do things right. Because my lifetime is such a speck in the big world. And because trees are witnesses, right? There are witnesses, not just to our past, but to what we are doing here and now. Mm-hmm. 200 years from now, there will still be trees, you know, that will have recorded what we are doing here and now. So I feel this, I feel much more a sense of responsibility of making sure that when I'm gone, and, 200, 300 years from now, future dendrochronologists will look at these trees that they're,
Right. It's telling your history. Right. Yeah. Maybe not your personal history.
Oh, my personal history, yeah.
But the collective history of that time that you were part of. And that really is fascinating. I just want to say to the audience that, again, we're chatting with my guest, who's the author of The Circle of Ancient Trees, Valerie Truitt. And Valerie, I want to ask you, is there a website or anything that you would like to share with the audience if anybody wants to, dig in a little bit deeper?
Yeah, there is. You can go to my personal website, which is www.valerietruitt.com. Truitt is Truett, or you can go to the website of the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research at the University of Arizona, where you can learn everything about tree rings and even more than you ever thought you wanted to know.
Okay. And if you have children, if you have small children, what would you encourage parents to do in encouraging their children to be more aware or more curious about all of this?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for asking that. I think, what you do, Sonia, take your kids to a forest. It doesn't need to be a big wild forest. It can be a small, it can even be a park in your neighborhood if there's not wild nature around. But encourage that curiosity about nature in your kids. It's not just good for everyone's mental health, it's also a great way to strengthen the link between people and nature. We need
absolutely we definitely need that, and we can pull the kids away from those phones and the devices. And it's so, yes, like, you know, Valerie was saying, it's not just healing, but at the same time, we do have to take that point into account as well. The effect that it will have on you and your child, you know, going out and being part of nature. Some years ago, I ran into a woman in a Chinese health food store. Turns out that she used to be a doctor in China. And one of the things she said to me, she said, one of the most healing things you can do for your eyes, eye health, is to stare at green, at trees.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, right. And so I thought, And then years later, I was watching one of the science shows on one of the channels here. And so they were talking about that the what we see with leaves that look like they look green, but that there were all the spectrum of colors that were actually there. Our eyes, we were interpreting this as one solid, you know, green, but there were multiple colors that were really actually part of that leaf. And so for me, then I started to put it together. I thought, oh, okay, that must have something to do with the impact on the eyes, because the brain, you're seeing with your brain anyway, but you're able to pick up those particular light frequencies from the leaf, and it's being interpreted. And so it's having a healing effect on your eyes. But anyway, so I had to throw that
in. Yeah, no, can I pick up on that? Because one thing about the book, In a Circle of Ancient Trees, is it's very much related to what you just mentioned. The text, it's in dark green, not black. The text, so it's written in dark green, and it's very soothing on the eyes. Mm-hmm. I was very surprised. My publisher is actually the ones that suggested it. I'm like, yeah, that's a cool gimmick, but then when you see the result, it's like, oh, this is so much more soothing.
Yeah, it's really appropriate.
So that must be related to what you were just saying.
Yeah, absolutely. I started really looking at that, but that's true, because you know, there's so much that we don't see. I mean, you know, so many colors are what the brain allows us, the spectrum that we get to actually observe. But there's all these other layers going on underneath it. So I thought that was really fascinating. And another aspect of that question, this was with the children. Now, in terms of just in general, what can you say about what we may need to do more of? If people are thinking about what can we do more of in terms of, you know, this changing environment, as far as from a climatic standpoint and environmental.
Yep. I think people ask, I get that question a lot. And so from a climatic perspective, I think we would all be well off by, to the extent of our possibilities, and these are different for everyone, in every decision that you make, to think about what is the most climate friendly way that within my means that I can do what I do, whether it is commuting to work, whether it is going on vacation, whether it is what you eat, how you grow your yard, all of these things, when you buy new clothes, to decide for yourself, you know, within my means and within what I'm comfortable with, and what way, and by climate friendly, I basically mean burning the least fossil fuels. I think that's, at least ask yourself that question and make a decision. I think that's an important question to ask oneself when making decisions. Yep.
Okay. I'm probably close to the last of the questions. You have talked about the rings, but is there observation of cycles, like it has recorded, or the trees record, that there really are cycles you know, that the planet goes through cycles. Besides what we're talking about with, you know, the humans and their impact on the environment, are there really cycles that we are dealing with?
Yeah, on different levels. Of course, with tree rings, we're a little bit limited in time. So the biggest cycles would be the ice ages, but those are further back in time than we can really record. With tree rings, you know, they don't go back beyond the last ice age, you know, which was about 20,000 years ago. On shorter time scales, there's climatic cycles. There's the El Nino system, which you might have heard of, that occurs every seven-ish years. There's some longer scale, yeah, oceanic and climatic cycles. And then another cycle I'm thinking of is I was talking about fire history. So prior to the 20th century, before the 20th century, before, you know, human interaction with fires and suppression of fires, large-scale suppressions, in the many of the forests in the American West, there would be a 5 to 10 year cycle in which the every forest would burn every 5 to 10 years, more or less. A cycle in which the underbrush and the grasses would be burned off, and then they'd get 5 to 10, maybe 15 years to grow back, and then another fire would come and there'd be enough fuel to have another, the next forest fire. So that's a little bit of cyclicity there as well. And enough grass and enough brush and small trees to create, you know, when a lightning hit, then there would be a fire. But then the fire would then burn off, clean out, let's say, the forest and burn off that grass and underbrush. It would take maybe 5 to 10 years for there again to be enough fuel,
right?
Resurgence. And it would, yeah, exactly. And then it would happen again. And now, in the beginning of the 20th century, with the establishment of the Forest Service, we started putting out all of these natural fires. And now,
that's what I was going to ask you about. Yeah. That. Yeah, yeah.
So now that cycle has been disrupted. It's no longer there. Yeah.
Okay. So because I noticed that this is something that, you know, obviously forest rangers, people, whoever, are setting these, what do they call it? Not sustained fires, but
prescribed.
Yeah, control fires for that purpose. But exactly. But that is, that sort of disrupts the natural cycle. Is that what you're saying?
No, the natural cycle had already been disrupted.
So
at the beginning of the 20th century, we started putting out these fires, suppressing these natural fires with the best of intentions. We didn't know back then that that was actually a necessary and natural part of the forest ecosystem. So as a result, instead of that underbrush and those grasses being burned off naturally every, you know, 5 to 10 years, now we have 100 years of grasses and underbrush, and that's way too much. So now when a fire burns, it gets into a big, big destructive fire. And so to reduce the amount of fuel in the forest, to reduce the amount of underbrush and grasses, that's why the Forest Service now does prescribed fires or controlled fires. Actually, in a way, to try and mimic the natural, or to create the natural cycle.
Yeah, and that describes, when we were talking about that, this is a system, and these are systems, and so there was a disruption with the system, and that's what we're talking about with an intelligent system that manages itself.
100%.
And the same thing with the human body. There's so many things that that naturally can resolve itself in us too, but we've also disrupted some of that natural ability, because there's so many similarities between us and nature, the design. I think if more people really dug into that, they would see the similarities. When I look at trees, and, you know, especially in the wintertime, and it reminds me of the brain and neurons and pathways, you can see that. And it's like, wow, it's like new eyes. It's like, wow, you're seeing more. And a rock, you know, I do the same thing with rocks, because rocks also, I mean, they're just some ancient rocks, and they carry, you know, tremendous history as well. So, yeah.
Sure, yeah. Or river systems. I often look, when you look at river systems on a map, you were talking about the neurons and the trees in winter. If you look at a river on a map and how its side rivers spread out into a delta, that's very similar as well.
Right. So many similarities. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, yeah, this has been a really great talk. Chat, really enjoyed having you on the show. And I could talk to you for a while.
We
love nature. You know, we love Mother in all her different aspects. Appreciate, I'm telling people, appreciate even the moments when it looks like everything is dry. And because people tend to go, oh my God, you know, everything is dry. We're sort of spoiled, you know, we're never satisfied. So it's that appreciation for that and realize that, like you know, you go through these cycles too. And, you know, we resurrect ourselves so many times. So I thank you so much for being a guest on the show, and I look forward to having you back again. And thank you for your work. And is there any last word that you want to share?
I just wanted to thank you, Sonia. I really very much appreciated and enjoyed this conversation as well. It's been my honor to be on your show.
Thank you so much. All right. To my listening audience, thank you so much for tuning in, for listening in. Thanks to our board operator as well. And please be sure to visit theexpansionzone.com for the archive of all the shows, including this one. And also my other websites. If you want to know more about me, there is therealsoniabarrett.com, and there is neuroradical.com, and anything else, possibilitiesacademy.com as well. Again, I like to remind you to live life to its fullest and question everything. Until next time, see you then.
Everybody's talking about consciousness. Everybody wants that eternal.
Support comes in part from The Broad Stage, co-presenting the Santa Monica International Jazz Festival, Friday, May 1st through Saturday, May 9th, 2026. Conceived by virtuoso bassist and jazz fusion pioneer Stanley Clark, this week-long celebration bridges the history of jazz with its future. Highlights include a centennial tribute to John Coltrane on Friday, May 8th at The Broad Stage. On Saturday, May 9th, bring the community together at Tongva Park for a day in the park featuring the sonic explorations of Kumasi, Washington. The Stanley Clark Band. And Miles Electric Band. Further information, including full schedule and tickets, is available at smjazzfest.com.